Welcome to Prostate Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. The widespread utilization of PSA screening has dramatically altered the face of prostate cancer, and I met with Dr. Eric Klein to explore the clinical implications of this massive stage migration and other trends in prostate cancer clinical care and research. Dr. Klein began our conversation by reviewing the impact of PSA screening on the stage of diagnosis of prostate cancer at clinical presentation.
When PSA was introduced, about half of newly diagnosed cases of prostate cancer in the United States were incurable, either because they had escaped the capsule of the prostate locally or they were metastatic at the time of presentation. And in the late 80s and early 90s, just when PSA screening was starting to penetrate the population, the American Cancer Society did a screening study, and they showed in the course of 5 years between 1987 and 1992 that the likelihood of having incurable disease at the time of diagnosis dropped from 50% to about 5%. And that was the first observation of what we call stage migration, which was patients presenting at a much earlier stage and at a time when more of the cancers were curable. We then published a paper in the Journal of Clinical Oncology around 1997, which gave us 10 years of follow-up after PSA was introduced. And what we saw in that paper was that the likelihood of having cancer all contained in the prostate, organ-confined disease at the time of radical prostatectomy in 1997 was much higher than it was in 1987, despite the fact that average PSA levels and the average age of the patients hadn't changed very much during that time. So what that suggested to us was that we were seeing, after the clinical stage migration that was seen in the American Cancer Society study, we were seeing what we call a pathologic stage migration to earlier and earlier stage disease for the same diagnostic factors at diagnosis. And what that means is that a man who walked into our office in 1997 with an average tumor, let's say one that's non-palpable, a PSA of 6 and a Gleason 6 tumor on biopsy, was more than twice as likely to be cured by surgery than the same man with the same parameters in 1987. And the reason is that the man who walks into the office in 1997 had probably been screened a few times during the course of his life or that 10 years, and the tumor was picked up at an earlier stage. The implication was that the major gains that we've seen in cure rates, which are clearly published by many people now, that cure rates, for example, in men in the late 90s for radical prostatectomy approach 90% or better, as they do with brachytherapy and external radiation therapy. It suggested that a lot of that benefit or that gain in cure was due to the pathologic stage migration in men presenting with more curable tumors rather than any true therapeutic advance. It's not like we introduced new drugs that had a lot of activity against prostate cancer then. We learned, with surgery at least, that hormone therapy didn't have any effect on the outcome after prostatectomy. And so all the therapeutic gains there were probably related to stage migration. That's not to say that we didn't get better doing prostatectomy, that we didn't get better doing brachytherapy, or that there aren't real therapeutic gains, particularly in external radiation therapy, with the recognition that higher doses are needed to cure prostate cancer and with conformal techniques that allow for higher doses with the same or less toxicity, or the use of hormone therapy in men with really advanced disease. Those are probably real therapeutic gains. But our most recent study looked at the period after our previous paper, starting in 1998, to 2005, and what we have seen now over the last 5 or 6 years is this pathological stage migration has markedly slowed, and at least in a statistical fashion, we can say, I think that the PSA-induced stage migration has ended, and all the benefit that we are extracting out of screening men for PSA in terms of picking up their disease now has probably been realized. And so what that says to me is that the high cure rates that we have now will continue. But trying to cure everybody, making that next leap to the next level of cure, is truly going to require major therapeutic advances, which would be, I would think, with the introduction of new biologic agents that have some activity against prostate cancer, or a better understanding of how to combine radiation therapy after surgery for patients who are at high risk of relapse, or the use of adjuvant chemotherapy in men at high risk, and so forth.
What's happened to the age-specific death rate of prostate cancer?
It's gone down in the last 10 years, and it's controversial as to why. There is no clear link yet that says that screening for prostate cancer reduces mortality. No randomized trial has shown that, although there are two large ones that are in progress. One is the PLCO trial in the United States, which was about 150,000 men at various centers who are screened or not screened on a randomized basis. And I think that that study is not going to be reporting for at least another 3 or 4 years. And then there's a larger European screening trial that included somewhere in the tens of thousands of men in many countries in Europe. And that has completed accrual, and at least the first planned analysis is for later this year or next year. So we may have some data from that study soon that answers that question directly.
What's your take in terms of sort of the controversy about local management of patients with favorable tumors, particularly in terms of interdisciplinary decision-making and sort of the territoriality that we've seen in the past in terms of radiation oncologists and urologists? Where are we right now with that?
Well, I think the territoriality still exists. There are zealots on both sides of the question, and there's not a lot of data to allow patients or physicians to pick amongst the three treatments. The data that is available based on biochemical failure would indicate a high likelihood of cure at 5 and 10 years with any of those modalities in someone with a favorable risk tumor. We have new data that brachytherapy and surgery have better overall survival than external radiation therapy at 5 years. And the surgery is about 97% overall survival. Brachytherapy is just a little behind that. External radiation is about 92%. And the question is whether that's patient selection for comorbidities, although we controlled for Charlson comorbidity scores and they were pretty equal across, or whether there's some other biologic effect of the external radiation therapy or the use of hormone therapy, which we generally haven't used in our brachytherapy patients, that might accelerate the death rate there. We also have data going back a little longer to the beginning of the PSA era, 1990 to 2000, looking at cancer-specific and overall mortality in a large cohort of patients undergoing surgery or external beam radiation therapy. And again, what we found, regardless of risk group, low, intermediate, or high risk group, no difference in the likelihood of dying of prostate cancer with either surgery or external radiation therapy. There were a slightly higher rate of men alive with metastatic disease who'd had external radiation therapy. But whether that represents patient selection again or whether external radiation therapy doesn't control the disease as well as surgery, I think, is open to question. A couple other perspectives on it. One is the fact that we're still arguing about this after so many years suggests to me that there are not clear differences. If we saw big differences, a meaningful difference of 10% in outcomes, I think patients march with their feet. And when they ask what's the best therapy, that's sort of a surrogate question, in my view, of what's going to give me the best cure rate. And the fact that we don't have those, I think, means that we don't really know which is the best. Having said that, from the urologic perspective, I think one could make a case that there are some advantages to surgery, particularly for younger men. The first advantage is that you get a complete pathologic analysis, and you can do much better prognostication with a complete analysis of a removed prostate in terms of what the ultimate likelihood of cure is and the need for adjuvant therapy than you can simply based on biopsy data. And the reason for that is very clear and well known, that biopsy data often, perhaps a third of the time, underestimates the amount and aggressiveness of the cancer. So that's one advantage to surgery. A second advantage to surgery, at least theoretic one, is that you don't have to deal with treating local recurrences, at least ones that we can identify clinically. Certainly some men who have an elevated PSA after prostatectomy probably have a local recurrence, but it's microscopic, don't know where it is, and can't really treat it directly. Whereas there is the occasional patient after external beam radiation therapy or brachytherapy who has not only a local recurrence, but a symptomatic local recurrence, one that causes urinary obstruction. And they can be very difficult to treat, particularly if the patient has a radiation-induced stricture. Furthermore, there's a concern about late side effects with the radiation therapy approaches. I typically tell patients, based on my 17-year experience, that whatever side effects they have with surgery will happen in the first few months, and then they'll be finished the rest of their life. It's very interesting that many of the men that I operated on 17 years ago are still alive, and they are not coming into my clinic with late side effects due to surgery. They don't become incontinent. Obviously, with age, they may have a diminishment in their potency, but that may be an age-related phenomenon more than the treatment-related phenomenon. Whereas with external radiation therapy in particular, although much less than in the pre-conformal therapy era, we still do see some patients who have difficult urethral strictures, who become incontinent, who have radiation cystitis that requires intervention for hematuria, or still, again, less frequently, the occasional patient who needs to have major surgery to have the bladder or rectum removed. And then there is data that I think is real and something to think about in the external radiation cohort about a slightly higher risk of getting bladder or bowel cancer that's radiation-induced. And the issue there is that the latency for those cancers is probably on the order of 5 to 10 years. And for a low-risk patient who might be 45 or 50 years old, that's important because he'll be treated, and 10 years down the road, he may not be seeing his primary treatment physician anymore, and he may not be screened for a colon cancer or bladder cancer the way he should be because he's at increased risk. And just one other comment I'll make on treatment for localized disease. We commonly see in the community across the country enthusiasm for treating patients with both or with a combination of seeds and external beam radiotherapy. And I can only give my perspective from the Cleveland Clinic is that our team, including the radiation therapists, are not enthusiastic about that treatment. And the reason we're not is that we don't believe that there's any published evidence that suggests that the cure rate is any higher than either of those modalities alone, stage for stage. And furthermore, we are convinced that the side effect profile is worse when you give combination therapy. And serving as a regional referral center, the one complication that concerns us the most are patients with prostatorectal fistulas. And although they may not occur very frequently in a large center of patients treated that way, if it happens, that's a pretty devastating complication. And the only patients that we see who have that problem have been those that have been treated with combination brachytherapy and external radiation. We have never seen a fistula here in the modern era of radiotherapy or brachytherapy with either treatment alone.
Where are we right now with robotic and laparoscopic surgery?
Well, we have folks here who do them, and they're very popular across the country based on the marketing. I think if you take a very hard look at data, that the only proven advantage to those approaches are less blood loss. There's good data from Jay Smith's program. Jay's a very experienced open surgeon, switched to robotic surgery, that shows that discharge hematocrits are not significantly different, that pain is actually less for the first few days after open surgery rather than robotic or laparoscopic surgery. In his hands, there's no difference in margin rates, potency, or continence. There is data from Sloan Kettering demonstrating similar rates of potency and margins in open and laparoscopic prostatectomy in the most experienced hands, but disturbingly about a 25% lower rate of continence at 14 months in patients treated with laparoscopic surgery. So I think actually the most important factor in deciding what operation to have if you've chosen surgery is who the surgeon is and what the experience of the surgeon is and not so much what the approach is, because I really don't believe that anybody has demonstrated that laparoscopic or robotic approaches cure cancer more frequently. And in fact, in some series, the margin rates are a lot higher and they probably cure it less frequently. Nor has anybody convincingly demonstrated that return to regular activities is any quicker using those approaches. And we, again, being a regional referral center and having a very busy practice in all of them, we see complications with all three. So I don't think the complication rate is any less either. There is another interesting paper that you'd probably like to hear about, where Edson Panis of Wayne State University and Peter Scardino of Sloan Kettering and I pooled our data, and we looked at what the likelihood of cure was based on biochemical failure after open prostatectomy based on the number of prostatectomies by the surgeon. And so we pooled the data from our own practices and from other physicians at the various institutions where we've been. And what we showed was really remarkable. This is unpublished data. It showed that the learning curve for open prostatectomy is about 350 cases, but even surgeons who have done more than 1,700 still have a learning curve and that the cure rate continues to go up based on the experience of the surgeon. More importantly, the data showed that surgeons who'd done more than 1,000 cases had about a 10% better cure rate than someone who'd done fewer than that. And that was controlled for both clinical presentation parameters, grade, stage, and PSA, and pathologic parameters. And it showed that experienced surgeons, more than 1,000, had a 30% higher cure rate than individuals who had done 50 or fewer prostatectomies. So one of the concerns that I have about robotic prostatectomy is that many smaller community hospitals where the physicians don't do hundreds and hundreds of prostatectomies every year are doing the robot, and this data is very clear that the cure rates are not going to be as good as having the most experienced surgeon you can find do them. It's pretty astounding data to think that even if the patient has organ-confined disease, all the cancer contained in the prostate, it shouldn't matter who operates on them in terms of what their cure rate is. It should be dictated by the biology. But our data clearly shows that more experienced surgeons are doing something, factors we haven't identified yet, that result in a higher cure rate even for those men.
Could it be something related to selection of patients?
Well, we controlled very carefully for that. And so we statistically controlled for the year the patient presented, the prior experience of the surgeon, the grade, stage, and PSA at the time of presentation, and all the pathologic factors. So if you just restrict the analysis to patients who pathologically, after the fact, had cancer contained in the prostate, the cure rate is still higher in someone who's done more surgery.
Does that sort of make intuitive sense to you? Can you think of what it is that an experienced surgeon might be doing that would increase the cure rate?
Yeah, we've thought a lot about that, and we're not sure exactly what the factors are. One issue may be where the urethra is divided at the apex. Another issue might be that the experienced surgeons in this particular series at least tended to remove the entire seminal vesicle instead of leaving bits behind, and there might be some patients who have unsuspected seminal vesicle metastasis. It might have to do with how wide a cuff of tissue you take at the bladder neck. Even though the pathologist says it's organ confined, there might be some tumor left at the bladder neck. It might be related to how vigorously the surgeon irrigates the wound afterwards. Those are the obvious things, but so far we haven't come up with a good way of identifying which of the factors is important.
What about cryosurgery? Where are we with that?
Yeah, cryosurgery, I think, has matured nicely with experience. There are a number of centers that have done several hundreds of cases now and understand how to do it now in a way that for the average patient will treat the whole gland. The marketing hoo-ha that said when cryotherapy came out that potency could be preserved has now been completely debunked. If you treat the entire gland, the nerve bundles get frozen too. And it's being used primarily for radiation failures. And that's our preferred method here in Cleveland for treating radiation failures. It seems to be tolerated well. Patients go home with a suprapubic tube for about a week. The rate of urethral slough using current urethral warmers is very low. The rate of incontinence is pretty low. And the only concern still is that we still occasionally see a patient who gets a prostatorectal fistula. The other interesting area regarding cryotherapy and some other new therapies is what's called focal therapy, which is just to treat part of the prostate gland based on the idea that you can map out the cancer using a saturation biopsy, really identify which quadrant or which small portion of the prostate has cancer in it, and only treat that area. And that would certainly result in less side effects. What hasn't been proven yet is that it's safe to do that, and those patients need to be monitored for life and probably are going to require continued biopsy periodically, just as if they were on watchful waiting. So what the overall advantage of that approach is when one weighs against the psychological and cost problems associated with watchful waiting aren't clear yet, but it's gaining some popularity.
You mentioned before that there was a decrease in the age-adjusted mortality for prostate cancer. What's the magnitude of that decrease?
Yeah, I think it's about 10% decrease since 1987.
Is that kind of what you would expect looking at the model of how we view this disease and the stage migration that you just described, or is it maybe less than what we would have expected?
Not being a statistician to really work out what you might expect, my clinical sense, it's probably a little less than what I would expect. On the other hand, the Scandinavian randomized trial showed an advantage to prostatectomy that in relative terms was pretty remarkable, but in absolute terms was only a 5% reduction in the likelihood of not dying of prostate cancer. So it's still an aggressive disease when it's extracapsular, and all the fuss that we make about treating or how to treat localized disease with one of the three modalities may not be really where the debate needs to be. The debate probably needs to be in identifying patients at risk of metastases and new ways of treating micrometastatic disease.
I'm curious about your thoughts and the thoughts that you're hearing expressed in your SWOG prostate cancer committee meetings and other venues where investigators are kind of trying to plot the path forward. Where do you see as the greatest opportunity to try to really have an impact on prostate cancer mortality?
The greatest opportunity are identifying biologic-based or image-based methods, most likely are going to be biologic, I think, though, of those patients who have potentially lethal tumors at the time of diagnosis or who can be identified when they switch from indolent tumors to potentially lethal tumors. That will allow us to better select treatment. And there's no doubt that we are overtreating many men with low-risk disease, but our hesitation in not treating them is that we don't really have good clinical ideas of who really needs to be treated, nor do we have a good idea of when the appropriate trigger is in someone who's being watched. So I think we need those sorts of correlative translational studies to identify markers that can say, yeah, this patient needs to be treated. And then I think we need to continue to expand what has become an established multimodality therapy approach, similar to what's done for colon and breast cancer now, for patients with locally advanced or high-risk tumors, combining chemotherapy prior to surgery. That's been tried in a number of trials and has been disappointing. There are a couple of adjuvant trials now with chemotherapy. There are adjuvant trials in the works with some new biologic agents, and that's where we're headed.
You mentioned chemotherapy, which is being looked at in the adjuvant setting. What's your take, though, on what's being offered to patients with metastatic or hormone refractory disease, the docetaxel-based approach or regimens compared to what we were doing in the past?
Well, in the past, chemotherapy was rarely used in men with prostate cancer except for palliation of bone pain. The FDA had approved mitoxantrone and prednisone many years ago for that indication. I don't think anybody really had a sense, and the clinical trial that was done to support its FDA license never showed that it delayed progression. I think more and more men now are being treated with Taxotere appropriately and are benefiting from it. There was an adjuvant trial for men with high-risk disease after prostatectomy in SWOG using mitoxantrone and prednisone with hormones versus hormones alone, and that trial unfortunately just closed about 2 weeks ago because of an excess number of leukemias in the mitoxantrone arm.
How long is that trial up and running?
About 3 or 4 years, maybe a little longer than that.
Yeah. And do you think there are going to be enough patients or events that they're going to be able to say something out of this trial?
Probably not.
That's really a shame.
It is. There's one other industry-sponsored adjuvant trial that is asking two questions. One is early versus late therapy, assuming that the PSA is undetectable after surgery. And then the therapeutic intervention is hormones with or without Taxotere chemotherapy.
How do you find Taxotere and the docetaxel-type regimens being tolerated by your patients who are being treated with it?
Well, it depends on which cohort you're looking at. In the neoadjuvant setting, these are usually younger, healthy men, and giving it at pretty hefty doses every week for 6 or 8 weeks is tolerated reasonably well. The likelihood of having a severe toxicity, grade 3 or 4, is pretty rare. In the adjuvant setting, I don't have a lot of experience with Taxotere in the adjuvant setting, but I would think it would be similar. In the metastatic setting, it depends on the state of the patient. Someone who's perfectly healthy and is asymptomatic and has no bone pain and so forth complains a lot about the side effects, even though there may be benefit to it. Someone who is feeling poorly, has a lower performance status and pain, who is significantly palliated by the Taxotere, is happy to have it and does not complain so much about the other side effects that go along with it because compared to where they started, they feel better, whereas an asymptomatic patient who's perfectly healthy probably feels a little worse afterwards.
Do you think there's any role for the use of chemotherapy in PSA-only disease, for example, a younger patient with a rapid doubling time who's hormone refractory?
Yeah, we don't know the answer to that yet, but there are studies that are addressing that issue.
Is that a strategy you would consider for outside of a protocol setting right now?
I would not, and the medical oncologist that I work with also would not. We really try and put that patient, someone with a rapid PSA or even any rising PSA, on a clinical trial using a number of new agents, GM-CSF or Revlimid in the thalidomide family, some antibody studies, anti-angiogenic agents, that sort of thing. I think there's a huge need in that area to identify the therapeutic strategy that works best. And so we really encourage all of those patients to go on a clinical trial. In other centers, they are looking carefully in men with slower PSA doubling times at nutritional and lifestyle interventions, which I think are also worth looking at. Currently, I don't think the evidence that chemotherapy would benefit those patients is sufficient to justify the cost and toxicity.
Can you talk about your own clinical approach in a non-protocol setting to the patient with PSA-only progression after prostatectomy?
Sure. At first, it depends on the age and the general medical condition of the patient. And then I pay a great deal of attention to PSA doubling time, which I think is a very useful clinical tool. And so if you look at the data that D'Amico published relating PSA doubling time to the risk of dying of prostate cancer, it showed that if your PSA doubling time is very short, 3 months or less, median survival was about 5 years. If your PSA doubling time was greater than 12 months, median survival was greater than 10 years. And so I tend to put patients into three categories. If their PSA doubling time is 3 months or less, they need hormone therapy and either the addition of chemotherapy as part of a protocol or to join some other protocol. If their PSA doubling time is greater than 12 months, I tend to follow them and not treat them and counsel them that this is not a life-threatening event at this point and that they can live many years with a slow PSA doubling time. For individuals who are in between 3 and 12 months, generally someone with a PSA doubling time less than 6, I would put on hormones and observe. For men with PSA doubling times between 6 and 12 months, it would either be dietary and lifestyle intervention or a clinical trial with a relatively non-toxic agent.
Any research going on right now in PSA-only disease that you'd like to comment on? You were talking about some of the newer agents that are being looked there, new strategies.
Yeah, I think all the strategies are interesting and deserve exploration. And right now, I would not say that there's a clear winning strategy that's emerging. Prostate Cancer Foundation is sponsoring a placebo-controlled trial using pomegranate juice, which has some in vitro activity against prostate cancer, presumably as an antioxidant. I think the new classes of anti-angiogenic agents look interesting. Bevacizumab, perhaps. Sutent and sorafenib haven't really been looked in that setting just yet. The thalidomide group looks interesting, seems to have some activity in metastatic disease. And then there are vaccine-based approaches, which I think are also interesting, and some trials that are maturing soon that will tell us whether the current generation of vaccine or immune-based therapy is useful.
Can you talk a little bit about satraplatin, a new agent that seems to have some activity in prostate cancer?
Yeah, satraplatin is an oral platinum analog that seems to be relatively well tolerated and probably best not to make any comments about it until the ASCO meeting in June, where the results of a phase 3 randomized trial are going to be presented. I have not seen the results of that trial, and so I wouldn't want to comment on them.
Anything you want to say in terms of what we've seen in other studies of that agent in terms of tolerability, side effects, and efficacy?
You know, the phase 2 studies look promising, which is why it moved to phase 3 on all of those issues. And the second-line therapy in men who are refractory to taxanes or other agents is always going to be difficult. That's the most resistant disease. So even a modest benefit, given its tolerability, would probably be viewed as a positive.
Anything come out in terms of clinical research databases or papers in the last, you know, let's say year or so that you think are important for urologists, radiation oncologists in practice to know about?
You know, I think all the data that Anthony D'Amico published on PSA doubling time as a predictor for prostate cancer-specific mortality is important and, again, useful, and I've already commented on how I use them. There was a lot of interest in the SEER-based data published by Wang in JAMA a few weeks ago suggesting that men with prostate cancer, even men over 65 and even older, men who got treated did better than men who got watched. And I was initially excited by that data, but a closer look showed that the actual mortality rate in that cohort of men due to prostate cancer was very low. It was only about 2 or 3%. And there's a clear suggestion, therefore, that even though they did a great job of controlling for every possible comorbidity, that there's some selection factor there, and that even though the urologic and radiation therapy community can't really agree on what the best treatment is, we seem to be pretty good as a group at identifying who's going to die of something else rather than their prostate cancer and who doesn't need to be treated. There's interesting data from the prostate cancer prevention trial, which in the placebo arm really was a large-scale screening study that was better than prior screening studies because everybody was biopsied at the end of the trial. So we really have a hard endpoint instead of patients in other screening trials where they weren't biopsied. And the interesting data there is that men who took finasteride, actually taking finasteride makes PSA a better screening test. So Ian Thompson and his colleagues published a paper in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute that showed that you are more likely to find cancer and more likely to find high-grade cancer using a PSA trigger for biopsying in men who have taken finasteride. So with full disclosure of not having any financial links to Merck research or otherwise, and recognizing that what I'm going to say now is completely off-label use of finasteride, I have in my own practice, based on that data, taken men who have had elevated PSAs at least two sets of biopsies, and rather than rebiopsying them, putting them on finasteride for 6 months. And if their PSA drops by 50%, then I'm comfortable that they don't have cancer and I continue to follow them. If their PSA drops by less than 50%, that's sort of a provocative test that there might be cancer there and that they need to be rebiopsied. And then the other thing that data showed was that any even small rise of 0.1 or 0.2 nanograms that's confirmed in men on finasteride needs a biopsy. So that's the way I've adopted that data in my practice. Not proven prospectively yet, but I think it makes a lot of intellectual sense to do that.
That's fascinating. Anything coming down the pike in terms of genomic or array or proteomic analysis of prostate cancer tissue? We've seen some exciting things in breast cancer, the Oncotype DX assay, and now they're looking at it in colon cancer. What about prostate?
Yeah, we're working with Genomic Health to look at it in prostate cancer, and all I can say is that preliminary studies in terms of feasibility look very promising, and we're very excited by that particular approach.
I'd kind of heard that they were thinking about prostate. Who actually is working with them?
My group and the pathologists here are providing tissue and, you know, follow-up data on outcome. We've done some pilot studies to determine whether the kind of fixative that was used to fix the prostate, because that's changed for us through the years, would affect the analysis, and the answer is no. We've also looked to see whether the age of the archival specimens would somehow affect the analysis. That's important because we have archival specimens going back to the mid-80s, which gives us 15 or 20-year follow-up on the patients. And the answer to that is the older the tissue, the less RNA you get out of it, but it's still high quality and usable.
I know you've done some interesting research related to viruses in prostate cancer. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, this is a fascinating area. There is epidemiologic evidence that suggests that prostate cancer is an infectious disease, evidence that suggests that men with a prior history of prostatitis or sexually transmitted infection are at higher risk of developing prostate cancer. Some recent studies that have suggested in particular, that men with antibodies in their serum to herpes virus 8 or antibodies in their serum to T. vaginalis are at higher risk of getting prostate cancer. There's some evidence from a sexually transmitted infection clinic in Baltimore that suggests that men who are actively infected have a rise in their PSA and then a fall in the convalescent phase, suggesting that an infection in the lower urinary tract actually causes inflammation in the prostate. And when you couple that data with the interesting hypothesis and histologic and genetic data suggesting that lesions like proliferative inflammatory atrophy are precursors to high-grade PIN and then to cancer, and other data that suggests that inflammation in the prostate due to a variety of insults, not only infection but dietary causes and environmental causes and so forth, there's a solid knowledge base there to suggest that prostate cancer might be infectious. And I say that in the background of recognizing that about 20% of all cancers worldwide are actually caused by infections, and that includes common things like cervical cancer due to HPV, liver cancer due to hepatitis B and C virus, bladder cancer due to schistosomiasis, liver cancer due to liver flukes, and stomach cancer due to H. pylori. And so it doesn't seem all that unreasonable to believe that prostate cancer being in the lower genital tract and exposed to pathogens passed by the urethra, perhaps by sexual contact, could be infectious. So in that background, about 10 years ago now, there was a genome-wide search published in a cohort of about 150 families that identified a gene on chromosome 1, not a gene, but a locus on chromosome 1, just a segment of chromosome 1 that predisposed certain families to prostate cancer. And Bill Isaacs and Jeff Trent at the NCI at the time cloned out a gene that they called HPC1 that seemed to be the causative gene. It turned out that HPC1, the protein and the actual gene structure, had been cloned in the early 90s, around 1992, 1993, by a scientist that I worked with named Bob Silverman, and that the HPC1 gene makes a protein called RNA-cell. RNA-cell is part of our innate defense against viruses. And so anytime we get virtually any viral infection, a coronavirus for a common cold or norovirus that causes diarrhea on cruise ships or influenza virus, this enzyme gets turned on, and it does two things to help prevent the spread of the virus within the body. The first thing it does is degrade single-stranded RNA, which is either the genome for an RNA virus or a replication intermediate for a DNA virus. And so it actually prevents the virus from replicating that way. And it also causes apoptosis of the cells that it gets turned on in. And since these viruses need intact host cell machinery to replicate, that also helps to prevent the spread of the infection. So we had sort of a fascinating convergence of epidemiologic and histologic and genetic and susceptibility data that brought us to the observation that men who have a certain variant, what we call a single nucleotide polymorphism in the HPC1 gene, are more prone to prostate cancer. And in animals who have that variant, they're more prone to viral infection. And in fact, they're more prone to die of the viral infection. So we did a very simple experiment in retrospect, which was to harvest tissue from men undergoing prostatectomy from the peripheral zone of the prostate where their tumors were and extract the RNA from it. And in collaboration with Don Ganim and Joe DeRisi at the University of San Francisco, we hybridized it to a chip-based technology called the VIROCHIP. This is fascinating technology. It's a DNA-based array chip that contains conserved sequences from every known virus up till the time that it was published, every known virus in man, in humans, in animals, and in plants. So it's a screen that represents about 1,000 known viruses. And using this chip, you can take biologic samples and hybridize it to the chip, and you can see if the samples contain viruses that belong to known classes of viruses. And this was the group that identified the SARS virus as a coronavirus, which is in the same family as the common cold virus, which by itself is a little scary to think about. In any event, they took patients who had SARS and they took respiratory secretions and they hybridized it to the chip and they saw that the SARS virus had sequences in it that were similar to coronaviruses. And then you can scrape the RNA off the chip or the hybridized DNA and clone out the whole virus. So we did that with the prostate samples. And in what we think are fascinating results, we found a brand new virus that was not directly represented on the chip that had never been seen in humans or plants or animals before. Initially, it was 9 men who had prostate cancer, and that was done blind to the knowledge of whether or not they had this SNP in the HPC1 gene. And when we correlated the presence or absence of the virus with the presence or absence of the SNP, we were astounded to see that in more than 90% of the cases, we found the virus only in the men who had the variant in the HPC1 gene, and we've expanded that observation now, and it still holds. The biologic properties of the XMRV virus are very interesting. Its nearest relative is murine leukemia virus, which causes leukemia in animals. So here we have men with a variant in a gene that predisposes to prostate cancer, who have a new virus in their prostate that's related closely to a virus that causes cancer in mammals. And so we're very excited by the possibility that this could be an important cause of prostate cancer. We certainly haven't proven that. But there are clear clinical implications to this. One would be screening men at a young age, not only with PSA, but for their HPC1 status. And if they have this variant and seem more prone to get prostate cancer, they probably would be screened more frequently or maybe even biopsied more frequently. A second would be to determine on biopsy whether or not the virus is present, or to determine in serum using an antibody assay whether or not the individual has been exposed to the virus. And those men, we would think, would also be more likely to get prostate cancer. A third possibility would be if we can work out the molecular details as to how this virus might cause cancer, we could develop new therapeutic agents to prevent that. And I think the one that is really the big picture one that I'm most excited about is the possibility of developing a vaccine to prevent infection with the virus and prevent at least some cases of prostate cancer. And that's not an extraordinary thought anymore, since there are one and soon to be two FDA-approved vaccines for cervical cancer.
Any estimate on what fraction of the total number of prostate cancer cases will fit into this syndrome?
Yeah, it's based on the population prevalence of this single nucleotide polymorphism. It's on the order of 10 to 15%. So that particular agent, you know, blocking that agent may or may not, it might only affect that population. It might affect a wider population. But I think it's a, in addition to the specifics related to XMRV and its biology, it's a paradigm-setting observation that will now allow us to look at other potential infectious agents that lead to chronic inflammation in the prostate and a similar sort of strategy in screening and in therapy and in prevention.
I'd like to find out a little bit about what's going on with the SELECT trial. I'm curious if you can kind of refresh our memory in terms of what the trial is looking at, when it was launched, and where we are right now.
Sure. SELECT is looking at whether or not 200 micrograms a day of selenium or 400 micrograms of vitamin E daily by mouth alone or in combination can prevent prostate cancer. And the trial eligibility were healthy men, Caucasians age 55 or older, African Americans aged 50 or older, normal rectal exam, PSA of 4 or less. And we accrued, starting in July of 2001, a little more than 35,000 men. The trial accrued in record time. We had planned to take 60 months to accrue that many men, and in fact, it only took us 33 months. And we just went through this summer our first look at the actual endpoint, the incidence of prostate cancer among the four arms of the trial, which are selenium plus placebo, vitamin E plus placebo, both of them together, or placebo plus placebo. And although I'm blinded to the actual data, the Data Safety Monitoring Committee reviewed the data and voted to continue the trial as is, which suggests that at the five-year mark, that there is no significant difference in the likelihood of having prostate cancer in any of those arms. That's an inference on my part. I have not seen the data. The other important issue with SELECT is that there have been some studies published in the last several years suggesting that doses of vitamin E greater than 400 milligrams might actually have detrimental cardiovascular or cardiac effects. And the Data Safety Monitoring Committee looked at all of that data in detail, including some unpublished data from some of the cardiovascular trials, and again voted on multiple occasions now to continue the trial as is, which is a strong signal that we are not seeing excess toxicity at the five-year mark in men taking vitamin E.
And how long are these men receiving the treatment or the intervention?
So it's planned to go a total of 12 years.
And based on your theoretical models or the background work preceding this trial, would you have hoped or expected to see something by this point?
We would not, in fact, have expected that. Vitamin E probably has a pretty rapid onset of action, but selenium is stored in visceral proteins, and it takes a number of years to take the kind of organic selenium that we're giving people and to have that replace the selenium that's in their body already. And furthermore, it took, as I said, 33 months to accrue patients. So it's only the very first patients who actually have five-year follow-up now. Those who were recruited at the end of those 33 months are only about 3 years into it. So the mean follow-up for the entire cohort is probably only about 3.5 years. So no, we wouldn't have expected to see anything yet. And I think we're on a schedule now to do these interim analyses probably every year now for the next several years.
And just to touch base, because you and I have been chatting about this really critical study on this series for many years now. Last time I talked to you, you yourself were taking vitamin E and selenium off study. Is that still the case?
Yes, it is.
The last thing I want to ask you about is your work on African-American men and prostate cancer. Can you update us on that?
Sure. The data in the literature are mixed as to whether or not African-American men have poor outcomes after treatment with surgery or radiation therapy. And there isn't a clear pattern there. Of the studies that are positive, though, to my knowledge, none have shown superior outcomes for African Americans. And of the ones that have shown a difference, they've all shown inferior outcomes. Early in the PSA era, that was thought to be due to barriers in the African American community to the idea of being screened and barriers to access of high-quality care with the most experienced treatments, or, you know, the ones that are practiced most widely or even best, and some evidence that African Americans were treated less aggressively than Caucasians were. So back in that era, our observation here at the clinic, which again has been confirmed by some studies and not others, was that African Americans presented with more aggressive disease at the time of diagnosis and therefore had worse outcomes, again, by about 10 or 11%. So now that we are well into the PSA era, now coming along just about 20 years, actually 20 years this year, we looked at whether or not that had changed later in the PSA era, with the idea being that through outreach efforts and mass education and a lot of work to try and reduce barriers to access, that the penetrance of PSA-based screening increased in the African-American community over the last 10 years, and that's certainly been shown to be the case. And so our hypothesis in looking at the data was that African-Americans would have significant improvements in presenting with lower stage disease at diagnosis later in the PSA era, and that if that equaled or exceeded what had happened in Caucasians, that the gap in outcome would also get smaller. And not surprisingly, we did observe that African-American men are presenting with earlier stage disease and in the same sort of magnitude that Caucasians are. The same sort of stage migration that I talked about previously applies to both populations. But surprisingly, there's no difference in the fact that African-Americans still have about a 10% lower cure rate with radical prostatectomy. And we could not explain that difference based on socioeconomic factors. We factored in income level and age and zip code and education level and so forth. So this data, along with a lot of other data and the suspicions of many other people, are that there may truly be biologic differences in prostate cancer in African-Americans and Caucasians. That's still a hypothesis. No one knows what that factor might be or how to do anything about it, but that's what the observation suggests to us.
It's fascinating.
There are some other hot areas. There are two really interesting things out of the University of Michigan, which are the ETS-ERG fusion gene story. In the past, it has been believed that the only cancers that have gene translocations associated with them were hematologic malignancies. And so, for example, in, I think it's CML, the BCR-ABL chromosomal fusion results in a novel protein that's not present in normal cells, and that's what drives the malignancy. And that protein became a target for developing a new drug, and that's how Gleevec came along. And that's the clinical significance of that. All the prior work on chromosomes in solid tumors has suggested that actual gene fusions and gene translocations and so forth were very uncommon. A really brilliant pathologist at University of Michigan, Arul Shanayan, used an informatics-based approach to look for low-frequency events in terms of gene expression in prostate cancers and did some great experiments that showed that, in fact, a substantial majority of prostate cancers do have submicroscopic gene fusions. And what's fused is a gene promoter that is sensitive to androgen, with a whole series, a whole family of genes called ETS, ETS, which are transcription factors. And when you have this fusion present, it drives the proliferation of prostate cancer. And it seems so far to be relatively specific for prostate cancer. This is really an exciting discovery. Again, it's a paradigm-shifting discovery because now we recognize in prostate cancer, which is the most common visceral malignancy, and most likely in all the other solid tumors, non-hematologic tumors, that gene fusions really do occur and are important. And so, again, it raises the issues of being able to identify a biomarker that's associated with aggressive tumors, and the early evidence suggests that these gene fusions do occur in more aggressive tumors. And the real excitement there is the development of new agents that interfere with the function of these fused proteins. And that may be the next major therapeutic breakthrough that we have in prostate cancer. It's many years away, but it would be a biologically based search for drugs that target a specific gene fusion, just like the BCR-ABL Gleevec story. And that's incredibly exciting, I think.
It is fascinating.
Yeah. The other two stories are a little bit less developed, but again, Arul Shanayan has demonstrated autoantibodies in the blood to PSA that seem to correlate with disease aggressiveness. And those studies are ongoing and prospective to determine whether the presence or absence of antibodies to PSA in the blood correlate with disease aggressiveness. It might be useful as a new screening tool. And then Bob Getzenberg at Hopkins has discovered an antigen called early prostate cancer antigen that seems to be associated with earlier stage disease. And again, based on serum antibody studies, might help tell us who's a good candidate for watchful waiting and who needs to be treated. The early data look promising. It was only in a few hundred patients, and there are prospective studies going on now that would be fascinating if they happen. And there's one other story that's come to mind based on a conversation that you and I have had, and I know this is a particular interest of yours, in terms of combined androgen blockade. I guess I'd like to add this to the section on papers that are important. This is an important one that just came to me. Charles Sawyers, who used to be at UCLA and is now at Sloan Kettering, published a really outstanding paper in Science that looked at the mechanism for androgen resistance in prostate cancer cells. And we used to believe that resistance to anti-androgen therapy came about because of mutations in the androgen receptor that made them no longer sensitive to the medications that we used to turn off androgen. And in fact, it turns out that prostate cancer cells that are androgen independent, that don't need androgen to grow, at least based on clinical scenarios, it turns out that they are in fact not resistant to androgens, but they are exquisitely sensitive to even the most minute amount of androgens in the cell. And that comes about through a variety of mechanisms that include both mutations and amplification of the androgen receptor. So the whole idea that LaBrie floated about combined androgen blockade and really needing to get cellular androgen levels down close to zero actually has a biologic basis now, even though clinically I think the cost-benefit ratio doesn't work out. But there's a strong biologic basis. And I think another major breakthrough, even one that's going to be sooner than the fusion protein breakthrough, will be the development of agents that directly target the androgen receptor and prevent it from binding from even the minutest amounts of androgen that are floating around. And then that'll be a whole new class of agents, I think. And I would bet that even in men with androgen-independent disease, that that will add substantially to longevity and really be a major breakthrough and might be useful for men as adjuvant therapy with high-risk disease as well. Those would be the promise that I would see for those. That's another very important story, I think.
Yeah, that's really interesting. There's a lot of analogies to what you just described in breast cancer, actually. Think about the aromatase inhibitors driving the levels that people thought were too low to stimulate the tumor even farther down.
Right.
And also the so-called resetting of the estrostat.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like what you're talking about is kind of similar.
Same thing. So LaBrie's idea now is not so crazy. It's got a good biologic basis, but we need better agents. I think the problem with the concept of combined androgen blockade is that the agents weren't effective enough because they didn't target the receptor. All they did was reduce the androgen, and you can't probably get it all the way to zero, and the toxicity is a little high.